Welcome to the podcast series BAB Interviews and Conversations presented by the Basler Afrika Bibliographien. Today's episode features the writer and editor Remy Ngamie from Windhoek, Namibia. Remy Ngamie is the co-founder of DUK, Namibia's only literary and visual culture magazine. Established in 2019, DUK has brought to the front new fiction, non-fiction poetry and visual art to much acclaim. Its beautifully curated editions enrich Africa's literary and visual design landscape. Early on, the Basler Afrika Bibliographien were invited to contribute from its archival holdings and within the curatorial frame of providing a window to the past. After a series of historical photography explorations, we now curate past Namibian voices in oral graphs. In this extract from a public presentation in Basel on 24th July 2024, Ngamie reflects on his path as a writer and imagining new literary futures in and out of Windhoek.
But maybe for some of you who might not know, perhaps I'll start with how the literary magazine got started, because I think that the origins of the literary magazine really helped to explain its mission, its successes and also its challenges and some of its failures. But back in 2017, I had just moved back to Windhoek in 2013 after having studied at the University of Cape Town. Cindy, are you from Cape Town? Joburg. Better. Lucky you. Yeah, but I'd spent the longest time living in Cape Town in South Africa, and that was where I thought my life was going to happen. When you are from what I call a small place like Windhoek, a place that does not have an identity outside of its immediate geography, you always yearn and want to be in the big parts of the world. Cape Town for us was the nearest setting, so a lot of us who, I would say, privileged private school kids aspired to be studying in Cape Town or Johannesburg. And while I was there, I started studying, in high school I was told I was very good at math and science, and so I should become a civil engineer, and so I applied for civil engineering, but I didn't get in, so I wound up doing construction studies and quantity surveying for 1 year before drastically changing my life around and saying, this is just not going to happen, and then I changed to English literature and law. After that, you know, like all English undergraduates, you graduate and then you realize this degree, reading books is not a way of living, doesn't pay the rent. So I wound up doing postgrad law and then I finished that. But after finishing that, I also realized I didn't want to become a lawyer. This is a big source of crisis for African families, because being a lawyer is like a very, very big aspirational thing. And so I changed my life around, and then somehow my work adventure in Cape Town did not materialize. Again, you have to understand, once you get to a place like Cape Town, you do all you can to fit in, so as a way of like making a life for yourself, because you can, the career opportunities and the prospects are significantly magnified in a place like Cape Town. And as a young person, I saw myself living in Cape Town, then obviously Joburg, and then after Joburg, the world is your oyster, London, New York, wherever. This is at least the childish impression that I had of my life at the time. But I wound up moving back to Windhoek in 2013. And so having been exposed to the wider world in South Africa, moving back to Windhoek was a bit of a punishing experience. It feels, the analogy would be like if you were recruited by a very big soccer team and you're from maybe, I don't know, a small town team here, and you get recruited by Real Madrid, and then you have 1 year there and you don't exactly really make it, and now you have to come back home. It feels coming back home for a lot of us who studied abroad felt like a failure, because migration is seen as, well, if you go, you have to make a success of this adventure. And so coming back home, it felt a lot like a failure, and it was very hard to adjust back into that vintage setting because it lacked a lot of the cultural things that make Cape Town the vibrant cosmopolitan place that it is. And one of these things was literature. There's literature in Namibia, but it is not produced in the scale or frequency that one would expect or desire it to. And by then, I'd also manifested the idea that I wanted to be a writer. The problem with this is that there's no clear path about how one goes about being a writer in this place. Everyone writes memoirs about being a liberation, being involved in the liberation struggle, or there's academic literature that is sometimes slightly very alienating, or there's worst management literature, or you know, the self-help literature about how I survived this and now I'm a millionaire. But there's nothing really in the way being produced in the way of fiction. By fiction, I mean the imaginative life that writers live in their heads. It's things that are not autobiographical. And I didn't have a way of writing this. So for a very long time, I felt stranded in Windhoek, not knowing how to do this. And like all writers and artists, you know, it's always impossible until you see someone else do it, and then you become jealous, and then you try. And so I spent a very long time in Windhoek being frustrated by not being able to write, knowing how to write, but not knowing the steps to go about it. I think the turning point was a random encounter at a bookshop in Windhoek called the Windhoek Boekhandlung, and it was run by this wonderful man called Wolfram, and he's a very well-known historian in Windhoek, or Rumbonde Books it was called. And the one time I was having one of these, you know, early 20s meltdowns in his bookshop, and I was like, well, you know, I think you should meet this a writer called Peter Orner. Peter Orner is an American author who had been in Namibia for his Fulbright. He'd been there for 2 years. And when he told me, when I Googled who Peter Orner was, I was convinced this man had committed a crime of some sort. Because there was no way this man with this CV, with these many books, being who he is in American letters, would be in Windhoek of all places. But I reached out to him, and Peter Orner, in his generosity, you know, got back to me and said, hey, I'm interested in starting a little informal writing group. Maybe you'd like to be a part of it. And Peter, I think because he was tied to the U.S. Embassy, or rather the Fulbright Fellowship, part of it involved doing events with the United States Embassy in Namibia. Peter rounded up this eclectic group of people who lived in Windhoek at the time, who were interested in writing. And so he ran an informal writer's workshop. We shared work with each other. We gave critique where we were able to give critique. And then as all things happened in Namibia, Peter had to leave. His Fulbright Fellowship came to an end. For us, it was a very big loss because we felt like he was a guiding presence for us. Again, if you get the chance, Google Peter Orner, and he's amazing. And then I picked up the responsibilities of leading the writing group. We kept it going every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, dependent on attendance, wherever we could find reading and writing space in Windhoek. And then COVID struck, and then the group disbanded. We just could not be together in the way that we wanted to be during early 2020. And that's where the idea of perhaps our small writing group has produced enough material to share with the world. Precursing this was that my book had been published in 2019, and it was about to be published, and it felt like there might be a moment where if this book gets published in South Africa, perhaps we can use that wave to push other writing to the fore. And so my co-founder at the time, Mutaleni Nadimi, approached me and said, look, if you get this book published, would you consider starting this literary magazine with us? And we use the momentum to start another momentum, another ripple effect. And then, so we agreed on those fronts and we started the literary magazine as a way of just sharing the writing that was coming from this group. So our first issue got published in August 2019. It was online. We figured out how to buy a domain, set up a look and feel for it, and we did the editing by ourselves. And our very first issue is still available online in the archive. And that's how Duke got started. We called it Duke because Duke is an Afrikaans word meaning a headscarf or a head wrap. And culturally in Namibia, all the cultural groups have some version of a head wrap. So it's a cultural symbol that everyone is familiar with. But Duke is also the phonetic last ending of Windhoek, the capital city. And so we attached it to that as well. The exclamation we put in as a head nod to a very influential literary magazine out of Nairobi called Kwani, which has the question mark at the end. We settled on the exclamation mark. And then that's how a small literary magazine was started, by a group of people who just needed a voice out in the literary firmament of the world, if you want to call it. Because we felt every place in the world has some form of literary representation, but Namibia did not. And as the eternal audience of one slowly garnered more attention or success, because I was involved in the literary magazine, the magazine sort of piggybacked wherever this book went. And that's how we managed to lift, I guess, our voices from a place of relative silence to now a place of relative prominence. During COVID, because everyone was stuck at home, everybody needed something to read. And we've never seen such engagement with our work, with other literary magazines on the continent. As at that time, I was lucky to be a part of a festival called Afrolit Sound Frontiers, which is a literary festival that was started on Instagram by Zukiswa Warner. And so many random things have happened to me along this journey, but one of them was just being recruited by Zukiswa to be part of this festival, and I said yeah, and then she put me in this WhatsApp group, and then I see the names of the other people who are in this WhatsApp group, and one of them is like Mukoma Wangugi, Ngugi wa Thiong'o-san, who's an academic in the US. He's a very big man in African letters. And then Maza Mengiste, like, who? How am I randomly in this group with Maza Mengiste? She's an Ethiopian-American writer who wrote The Shadow King and Beneath the Lion's Gaze. And these are very, very big and prominent writers. And so they were curious about who this other young African writer was in this group. And I said, hey, this is me. This is what I do. They took an interest in Duke, and they used their platforms to also amplify our message and our work. They assisted us with not only conducting interviews, but they contributed to the magazine as well. And so that's how, for example, this magazine has been able to go from certain obscurity to absolute prominence in African literature now, and also, I think I can say, global literature. The partnership with Basla Africa Bibliography has been spectacular and one of the best partnerships we've had, because we believe we are not only producing literature about the present that focuses on like what contemporary Namibians are thinking and writing about, but we also curate windows into the past. And by that I mean things that we know exist, but we've never seen or engaged with or had an opportunity to engage with. And the Namibian literary community is always fascinated by the things that come through our magazine, because these are works of film or photography or orographs that are not easily accessible to us, and they exist somewhere, and to have them curated or just even accessible, that access for us is so meaningful. Regardless of the complexity of the challenges that one might have to deal with afterwards about, well, what does this represent? Whose voice is being amplified? For us, that primary access is key. Without that access, there's no other conversation to be had about representation or power politics or anything. And so being able to curate the works that Basla has in its archives is absolutely important to us. We produce fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and visual art from Namibians primarily, Africans on the continent, and then Africans in the diaspora, wherever they might find themselves. For us, these three audiences are key, because we're not going to get anywhere as a literary community first if we don't engage with our own writing and our own work. But our own, we realize as a small community, we're going to need the help of our continental counterparts to get our work out. And so that's why we include other audiences from the continent and elsewhere. And we also include the African diaspora because we're curious to know about what they think and what they do and what interests them elsewhere in the world. Because we realize in a lot of ways migration is an inevitable thing. And so wherever it is one goes in the world, we would like to know that, you know, someone has walked these steps before. But also I see all of these things, Namibia, Africa, African diaspora, as being intimately connected. And it's impossible to have such a myopic view of publishing without engaging with all of these disparate voices.